I want to follow up on the call to action and say that I think all of us who do research in this world hope that the work that we do as a researcher matters to women. And I think people like Lynn, who have a foot in both worlds, who do the daily work to get women the access to abortion they need and work at the larger issue, that it's a model for all of us. So thank you, Lynn, for your leadership in that. And I also want to thank Lisa and Diana, who are the chairs of the Abortion Task Force. I think the presence of the fact that this is now the abortion room, you can stay in here and listen to abortion all day. And if you want to sleep here, you can join us again at 8:30 tomorrow, which says a lot about how hard people have worked to bring abortion back into public health. And I think that the task force and the leadership of the task force should be commended for that. I have no relationships to disclose. Someday, I actually hope that there is a funder that I will have to disclose, because it'll mean that some commercial entity is interested in this issue. So when we talk about abortion in the context of the U.S., we tend to focus on its moral, political, or its legal dimensions. That is, should she or shouldn't she have an abortion? Should she have the right to an abortion? Does a woman have a moral obligation to the fetus? Under what circumstances should abortion be allowable? Do I feel okay about it if she was raped? Do I feel okay about it if she's just been sloppy with her contraception? Is it constitutional to limit her right to abortion? These are the kinds of questions that we tend to focus on. But we also know in this room that abortion is a fundamental component of healthcare, and it is a fundamental component of public health. And that what we learned from Obama is that we haven't been very good at getting that message across. When he stood before the joint session of Congress and said, this is a healthcare bill, not an abortion bill, he told the country very clearly that abortion is not healthcare. And if we do nothing else over the next 2 years, we just need to say over and over and over again, abortion is a basic form of healthcare, and we expect it to be funded as such. But the public health attention is equally as problematic. We tend to focus on either the context of mortality, that is, what happened when abortion is legally restricted, whether it was in the United States or still globally, that is, who dies seems to matter more than whose lives are affected. We look at reducing subsequent abortion through post-abortion contraception, and there's an association, the Association of Reproductive Health Professionals meeting, which this year was in September, and I wanted to just call it the long-acting reversible contraceptive meeting. Because we feel like if we can get enough contraception, then maybe we can stop fighting about abortion. And while post-abortion contraception is critically important, it is not the solution to women's access needs for abortion. We look at reductions in abortion as a universal good. You will never see an immediate coverage with any public health advocate who says, the abortion rate dropped from 1.4 million to 1.2 million. I wonder if those 2 million women really wanted to have an abortion or not. Our data is often produced for political purposes without rigorous attention to its larger implications. So I'm going to take this conversation up a level and tell you a little bit about the work that we're doing to try to contextualize abortion within this larger approach of healthcare disparities. We are here, we are talking about healthcare disparities. I was struck in the last session when I went to see David Williams talk how much attention we pay to infant mortality and how little attention we pay to who is it that has the infants that then die. So we are expanding our approach, our public health approach. This is the Abortion Disparities Project. It is part of our larger initiative to normalize abortion as regular health care. It's funded by the David and Lucille Packard Foundation. And this work is a collaborative effort of disparities researchers, abortion researchers, and reproductive justice advocates. You don't need to know this whole name, but to say that it has some leading experts in all of these areas to try to say, what does the conceptual framework look like if we brought abortion back into the picture of health care disparities? The potential outcome for this work that we hope that some of you will adopt is to provide a way of thinking about abortion where the public health context is the setting where abortions are already legal. So it's not about what happens when abortion becomes illegal, which is a very important question, but it's about what happens in today in a public health understanding in a place where abortion is legal. It provides another way to push back against the restrictions that we heard both from Amanda and from Lynn, and you'll hear again from Kate after me, about the expansion of abortion restrictions. And it shifts the debate away from the age-old question, should she or should she not have an abortion, but what does she need in order to exercise her reproductive rights? It's a very different qualitative question. go through briefly what all of you in this room can probably do in your sleep, just to remember where we start this conversation when we usually talk about abortion disparities. And we tend to talk about abortion use disparities. That is, we know that African American women have somewhere between 3 and 5 times the abortion rate of white women, that Latino women have somewhere between 2 and 4 times the abortion rate of women. And that for socioeconomic status matters enormously. The more poor you are, the more likely you are to have an abortion. And that the Guttmacher Institute revealed what I think is the most damaging statistic that we have yet to interrogate in our field, which is between 2000 and 2008, the percentage of abortions to poor women jumped from 27% to 42%, meaning this becomes disproportionately a healthcare need of the very poor in this country, and we have a different kind of conversation that we need to have about it. This shows you that the percentage of abortions to white women is declining over time, that the increased rate of abortions to Hispanic women is increasing. This is a racial, ethnic, and socioeconomic disparity in health. But do we really care about the differences in the rate of abortion? When we focus on the rate of abortion, we lead to a single, almost unitary solution to address the question of unintended pregnancies. But I would say we need to look at disparities in access to care. And that brings up two additional outcomes that are of interest. One is what the timing of abortions, which we heard a little bit in that last talk, and the other is the undesired childbearing. It's not, it's a public health meeting, that would probably be a problem. Okay, so what do we know about disparities in timing? We know that there are big racial ethnic differences in when women are able to obtain their abortion. Women of color receive their abortions later, both in the first trimester and in the second trimester. We know that the younger you are, the more likely you are to have your abortion significantly later in the second trimester, and sometimes moving you beyond the post-viability level. We know that low-income women have higher rates of unintended childbearing, and that that is both a racial ethnic disparity and a socioeconomic disparity. So then that leads us to a different kind of question, not just how did she get pregnant and how do we stop her from getting pregnant, but how do we assure that she has access to the healthcare services she needs at the moment in which she finds herself pregnant? What do we do about timing disparities and unwanted birth disparities? And I'm just going to talk about three things. One, I will talk briefly because I think you've had two talks on it this morning. That is insurance coverage. Best analogy I ever had, I heard, was at the last year's Health Disparities conference where they talked about insurance, Medicaid coverage for abortion is sort of like a hospital gown. It covers you in all the wrong places. So in addition to not having coverage, whether it's public or private or in the exchanges or in the high-risk pools or in the military, we also know that if you need an abortion, you're not likely to be able to find a place where it has an abortion. The number of abortion providers is somewhere about 1,700 facilities. Now think about this. There are 1.2 million abortions in this country. There are 1.2 million cesarean sections. Could you imagine if the only place you could get a cesarean section was at 1,700 places around this country? We would be outraged about lack of access. We need to put those numbers into context with other healthcare expectations. We know that those abortion clinics that are places which offer most of their services are abortion are continuing to concentrate, and the more we restrict access to abortion, the more we will continue to concentrate into facilities, and those facilities will be located in only certain geographic areas, and those will be harder to get to if you're geographically or socioeconomically disadvantaged. We know that already the abortion clinics are disproportionately in metropolitan areas and that there's huge distribution across state, right? So Arkansas has one abortion provider left. California has 400 abortion providers. You take California out of the mix, the entire rest of the country looks very, very different. We know that there's a lack of providers, right? That half of all medical schools still don't teach abortion in OBGYN residencies, and even when you have training, there are so many impediments after residency that very few providers are likely to continue to offer care even if they have been trained in residency. We know that there are scope of practice restrictions that limit family practice providers, nurse practitioners, physicians assistants, and midwives from doing abortions, and we know that there are facilities restrictions, new expectations against abortions in community health centers, a mandate that already a restriction that says if you work in a community health center, your malpractice coverage cannot cover your provision of abortion, even if you yourself would like to do it and women would like to pay for it. We have a rise in religiously owned hospitals, and we have new public center, huge infusion into public health, and those public health usually exclude abortion. And then we have just an onslaught of state-based restrictions since 1995, that is, since the Casey Supreme Court decision said that you could regulate abortion as long as it wasn't an undue burden. We have seen an exponential number of regulations at the state level. And I just wanted to read you, anybody read the New York Times this morning? Okay, so Troy Newman, who's the head of Operation Rescue, said this morning in the New York Times, and talking about the takeover of the at the state houses, "I feel like a little boy on Christmas morning. Which package do you open up first?" said Troy Newman, the leader of Operation Rescue and anti-abortion group. Already abortion opponents are considering pressing new regulations in New Mexico, Iowa, Kansas. And the new Republican governor, Sam Brownback, who follows Democratic governors who have vetoed most abortion limits, will now be approved in the state of Kansas. It is only going to get worse. So how do we shift this conversation? How do we as public health professionals get engaged in this? And this is our work, is to say we need to put abortion back into the context of healthcare disparities, and we need to do it in a way that mobilizes the amount of data and the amount of work that we have done around health disparities. So think about other conditions. Conditions like diabetes, heart disease, obesity, and HIV, all of which have huge pushes around prevention, right? There is a ton of money happening to address obesity in young people, to look at primary prevention of diabetes, to look at condom availability, to reduce contracting HIV. And yet in all of those circumstances, we never have a prevention message that also includes a restriction on treatment. We don't say, okay, well, sorry, you had diabetes, you didn't follow my fresh fruits and vegetable recommendations, so you know that leg you need severed off, we're not gonna have that anymore. We're gonna reduce access to diabetes care as a strategy to increase prevention of diabetes. We don't feel like those two are contradictory at all. We have a primary prevention message and we have a secondary prevention message. And at the healthcare level, when you don't have access to secondary care, we view that as a healthcare disparity. And I think that in the abortion context, we need to do the same thing. We can have a primary prevention message and we can have a secondary prevention message, and they are not contradictory, they are complementary. So this new framework talks about uncontrolled fertility as the sort of larger health condition that we want to look at. We want to have a primary, secondary, and a tertiary approach to uncontrolled fertility rather than looking at any individual sort of component of it. And this just gives you some sense of where we're locating all of the healthcare disparities data and where we're trying to put abortion back into the picture. So we know that there are disparities in sexual activity, we know there are disparities in contraceptive use, we know there's disparities in pregnancy ambivalence, all of which are contextualized in a world where, if there's one word we've learned to say at this meeting, does anybody know what it is? Racism. Yeah. So remembering, like, these things are not devoid of this larger contextual discussion. Those things have implications for different rates of unintended pregnancy, and differential rates of unintended pregnancy have differential needs for abortion, for undesired childbirth, and for desired childbirth, and that those things have implications for infant mortality, for maternal mortality, for the economic issues that we've talked about, and health impacts. And all of these need to be put back into the picture so that when somebody talks about infant mortality, they can't do it devoid of a conversation about where was abortion access in the course of that decision that a woman was making. So we think the implications for this new framework are to expand the public health message beyond preventing unintended pregnancy, to continue to contextualize it, how women can optimize their own experience receiving abortion care, not just preventing abortion, the need for abortion, but increasing their quality of care. How best to expand access so that we make real strides in improving access to care for underserved populations, and what are the effects of restricting funding? That is, we begin to say, what happens when you restrict access to funding for care, and how does that go down this larger chain? And then we encourage these concrete steps to improve abortion access. So hopefully this gives you a little different way to think about it, and when healthcare disparities discussions come up, you have a way to contextualize abortion within that larger discussion. So thank you very much for having me today. questions? Yeah. Lois, these are tough, I know.
This is really great. I love the idea of trying to get this issue into the health equity framework. I wanted to report we've had a little success actually doing this in New York recently. Healthcare for All New York, which is the statewide health reform coalition, has adopted our definition of health equity in health reform as including gender issues as well as race, ethnicity, sexual orientation, and class. And we're going to be trying to bring that model around to different states where coalitions like this are working on health reform to try to force our colleagues in the health reform field to accept that there are gender disparities, and you know, disparities is a broader umbrella, so this should be extremely useful.
Okay. Lois has done remarkable work. If you aren't already on the listserv for Raising Women's Voices, I highly recommend it. It is probably the most single informative source on healthcare reform.
I'm Jenny O'Donnell from the Abortion Access Project, and I'm wondering about the addition of referrals from your list of ways to improve access.
Yeah, that is an excellent notice of an omission. I will note that. Referrals are a really important place because we don't expect that all providers will have the technical skills to be able to do abortions, but every provider should have the technical skills to do a referral. So I think it's a great point and one we will add back into the model. So thanks. Leslie.
Hi, Leslie, Planned Parenthood Federation. This is terrific. I would love for you to maybe just say a little more about why you think we have uniquely separated primary and secondary prevention. Does this sort of go back to women aren't supposed to have sex? Does it go to we haven't thought, you know, whatever, the other side's done a good job? I would just love to hear.
So the question was, why have we separated primary and secondary prevention? Try to give you the short answer without too much of a historical lesson, but people probably remember that when Margaret Sanger was trying to work to legalize abortion in the United States, one of the first compromises that were made was the distinction that said abortion is not a method of family planning, it is not a method of contraception, and we've sort of maintained that big line. And then I think that we long for common ground. We so long for the mythical place where we can all agree that we can reduce the number of pregnancies, then we'll stop fighting about abortion. And I think that what we know from every fight in every state is that nobody has any idea how many abortions there are in their state. They're just fighting over whether it should be legal or not legal. So I think it's a historical thing. I think it's a common ground problem. And I think we, all of us are really uncomfortable with fighting. We're really tired. And so we think, okay, if I can stay in relationship with you long enough around this primary issue, then maybe we don't have to talk about secondary. But the problem is they're inseparable in women's lives, and so we're doing a disservice in order to maintain our own sense of, like, relationship with groups that we feel like we can agree on around primary prevention. Yeah, so the question was about the term uncontrolled fertility, and I think your criticisms about it micro-locating the source of the problem at the level of the individual woman is a really important one. We went over a whole bunch of terms, and we didn't want to call it undesired fertility, because one of the issues that's left out of all of this is infertility. So uncontrolled can include both the pregnancies you don't want to have and pregnancies you wish you could have. That's but anybody who wants to think about, you know, a different word, I would love it. We also didn't want to make pregnancy the problem because What we see is that when you make pregnancy a disease, right, so if you think about contraception as a prevention strategy, what are you preventing? And if you are preventing pregnancy, then pregnancy becomes the disease. And women who, and a lot of people, and certainly in our maternal child health sections, have worked a long time to de-link pregnancy from a disease, to make it a normal health state. So then what are you preventing if contraception is prevention? And so we were trying to find a word that is, you're preventing uncontrolled fertility. That is, in fact, a disease. It is something that women don't want. But it's not perfect. And I think you really speak to its significant limitations. So challenge to all of you, find me a better term. I will use it. One more question. The question was why this is opposed to a reproductive justice framework, and they're not meant to be one to replace the other. That's why a third of the working group is reproductive justice advocates who bring that. It was to try to say, for people who aren't ready to go to a reproductive justice place, people who are still very much in a public health mindset, is there a way in which we can take those same concepts of reproductive justice, package them into a set of language that they have become more comfortable with, and then move them along? But I think you're absolutely correct that the larger framework is this reproductive justice framework, but this might be another circuitous pathway in which to gain more public health allies along the way by using a language and a framework that they are already more conceptually comfortable with. But it's definitely not meant to supplant as a larger framework the reproductive justice, because that also has an economic component, a social justice component, a human rights component that aren't part of this. So it's a really good question. So thank you very much.